And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
I met David Miliband 8 years ago when he was the foreign minister of Great Britain, and it was my assumption that he would someday be the prime minister of Great Britain. He lost a very unusual struggle for party leadership with his brother Ed and left Britain and went to New York to become the director of the International Rescue Committee, an organization formed by Albert Einstein to advocate for refugees around the world. And in that role, he is now in the center of a humanitarian crisis as millions of refugees are routed from their home by violence, famine, persecution. He's also the author of a new book, Rescue, Refugees and the Political Crisis of Our Time. I sat down with David Miliband the other day at the University of Chicago, where he came to speak about his mission. David Miliband, welcome. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be on this side of the microphone rather than just listening to your podcasts in the gym.
Well, I'm glad you're doing that.
I do.
You look very fit, so I hope I'm contributing to that. You know, this issue of refugees is not an academic issue for you. Your family has a history that informs your passion about this issue. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it's strange. I'm a sort of middle-class British person, but the first refugees I ever met were my parents. My dad was a refugee from Belgium in 1940. My mum was a refugee from Poland in 1946 to the UK. If they had not been admitted to the UK, I wouldn't be here today. And so this issue of how the world treats those who for centuries were not counted and didn't count, these people who are victims of war and are expelled from their own countries, is personal. And I think that for my childhood, the Holocaust, I was born in 1965, so the Holocaust was sort of background music, but actually looking now, it was quite close. I mean, 20 years is not very long.
Yes.
And it's a long way away now, but actually when I think back to my childhood, there was a lot that was talked about, but there was also a lot that wasn't talked about. And you've had people on this program who've talked about how there are parts of family history that are so painful that they don't get discussed. And so I think for me, my parents wanted me to have the security that really they never had. My dad was born in 1924. He grew up in Belgium. The rise of fascism was the background music to his childhood. My mum, born 10 years later, you know, her country convulsed by war in Poland, you know, both Jews and my mother in Poland, my mother hiding in, first of all, in a convent and then with an incredibly brave family who saved her life in Warsaw. They wanted me to have as secure a childhood as possible.
Did they talk much about that experience?
No, they didn't. And my dad talked more because he'd emigrated. He'd been a refugee in the UK in 1940. He learned English, graduated, or got into the London School of Economics, did a year at the London School of Economics, which was then in Cambridge in 1941-42, and then joined the Royal Navy. So he spent three years in the Royal Navy, and he talked to me about that. And that was a much more an easier thing to talk about than, than what my mother's.
It's so interesting to me because, you know, my father was a refugee as well from Eastern Europe in the early 20s. He came here to the U.S. as a boy. Never, unless pressed, ever talked about that experience of being the victim of violence and persecution, having his home blown up, being separated from his parents and reuniting and so on. It was something that he just... It was such an awful experience he didn't want to talk about. The other thing that strikes me about his experience is he got here a couple of years before a very draconian anti-immigration law was passed by the United States Senate. If he had tried to come 2 years later, he would not have been admitted to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, it was my mother spent the war in hiding, and so I think that was much more terrain that wasn't talked about. Her father was killed in the war. I mean, amazingly, we've just in the last 6 months had a German historical group discover the documentation of my grandfather's transfer from Auschwitz to another concentration camp, and surviving members of the family, myself, my brother, my mother, and my aunt, we went to Germany a couple of weeks ago to see the site of this concentration camp and met some of the generations who've been determined that the truth will be told, generations of Germans. But I know that I had a very, very secure childhood, and I think that they wanted me to have the kind of foundations that they never had, really.
Mm-hmm. And so probably in addition to not wanting to share that history, it was probably either consciously or unconsciously, I'm just guessing, I mean, maybe this was true with my father as well, to say that was part of the past, you have a different future.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, I think they obviously hoped that, but they both of my parents had this strong sense that if you could make a difference, you should, and if you didn't, it was a waste.
Mm-hmm.
And they both had my dad was an academic, my mother was a teacher.
He was quite a towering presence in academia. He was a scholar on Marxism.
Yeah, your dad is never towering, I don't think. Or maybe you don't think of your dad as, your dad's your dad. It's someone who you can make fun of. It's someone who you can rib. So people say, oh, you know, you were the son of this academic. It makes it sound like this person sitting in an ivory tower. And, you know, my memory of my dad is taking me to soccer matches on a rainy Saturday morning. We lived in Leeds for 4 years, which is a northern industrial city, and we lived outside Leeds. And my dad was the least likely football soccer coach that you could ever imagine. But that's my image of him is with his head in his hands as the ball went through my legs and I turned around and saw the ball nestling at the back of the net. I mean, so towering isn't the word that comes to mind, although it's incredibly affirming when people say, someone said this to me last week, oh, you know, I read your dad's book.
Mm-hmm.
And someone just said to me, I'm going to do something later with the Institute of Politics. They said, oh, you know, we'll have to ask you about the Miliband-Poulantzas debate of 1973. I mean, a subsection of your readers will know what on earth that was about. But that obvious, I suppose I had a sense that he was someone who was a serious person who did serious work. But he wasn't someone who was kind of, towering suggests ogre, and that was not.
No, I understand. But tell me what was discussed in your household, and how much did, because he wasn't, my understanding was that he wasn't just a scholar, but he was someone who was very committed to some of the precepts that he studied.
He didn't just study Marxism, he was a Marxist. He was a member of the Labour Party in the 1950s. He attended the Labour Party conference in 1956. But he became a great critic of the Labour Party without ever joining another party. He was a sort of independent socialist, I think you would call him. My mother was a socialist and a feminist, I think, and probably taught my dad a lot about why feminism needed to be part of any progressive view of social progress. And I mean, you know, what was discussed around our table? What was discussed around our table was,
other than the ball slipping through your legs,
exactly,
and getting into the net.
The soccer, the homework, yes. Da-da-da-da. I don't want to suggest that every dinner table was a seminar.
Yes.
But politics was discussed. They did have friends from South Africa who were living under apartheid and fighting apartheid. They did have friends from Eastern Europe who were living under communism and were fighting against it. So they did have strong views of that Mrs. Thatcher was leading Britain in a backward direction. And so the 70s and the 80s were secure for me personally, but politically they were very charged times, even in a secure democracy. And so we did live in a household that was quote unquote political, and where politics was not considered off limits. It was very much in bounds.
And where people visited who were significant.
Yeah, I mean,
political figures.
Yeah, I mean, I was doing my homework in 1979 or 1980 on a weekday afternoon, and the bell rang. No one was home, and I went and answered the door. And Joe Slovo, who was the leader of the South African Communist Party, was huge dissident, an extraordinarily controversial figure on the radio. And there he was standing there, and he said, "Oh, you know, is your mum or dad in?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Oh," I said, "Do you want to come in?" So he came downstairs into the kitchen, and we spent 20 minutes talking. I remember he was drinking a glass of water; he didn't want a cup of tea. And he was friends of my parents. So I remember, you know, and then 1 or 2 years later, his wife was blown up by the South African security mm-hmm. forces. She was living in Mozambique as a dissident. So you knew that politics mattered, that politics was about ideas, but for some people, it was about life and death.
And you, and then you spent some years here in the U.S. as you were growing up.
Yeah, I played Mayor Slade in Destry Rides Again as a junior high school student in Newton, Massachusetts in 1977-78. And I was a graduate student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology in 1988-89. So there's a sort of transatlantic link for me. And it's strange in a way I've come back to live and work in the U.S., in New York. I'm not sure to what extent New York still counts as part. It's a sort of special part of the U.S.,
New Yorker certainly would say so. I'm a native of New York. Yes, so I gather.
But the America has been an important part of my life, and my wife's a dual citizen, actually. And so I've had the chance now to be a student in the U.S. and to work in the U.S. And obviously, I'm still a British citizen, but this is certainly the second most important country to me in my life.
What were your observations when you came here?
And as a 13-year-old, as a 12-year-old?
Yeah, as a kid, and then and as a graduate student later of America and America's politics.
Well, it was the land of opportunity in the 70s. That sounds surprising probably for you, because you remember you know this period, 76 to 80, as sort of misery years. For someone coming as a 12, 13-year-old from industrial north of England to Boston, Massachusetts, it was the land of opportunity. It was the land of plenty. It was the land where there were carpets in the bathrooms and showers, and not that there wasn't hot water in the UK, but it was you had baths, not showers. I mean, it's hard now, I think, to realize quite the distance between the US and the UK was much greater for most people at that time than probably seems likely today. And the homogenization that has happened, I think, as part of globalization was much less present. And so it was the land of opportunity. It was the land of plenty. Nowhere else had 32 different flavors of ice cream. Never mind orange juice.
That's why we have an obesity problem.
It was a land that certainly for me at the time was, I mean, we were living in a middle-class suburb. So I think it's important to emphasize that I was leading I had a sheltered view of the U.S., but now looking back, one of the things that's obviously a major issue today, both in my work and more generally, is to what extent does the US want to be a global power? And to what extent does it actually want to just fix its own problems? And if I think back now with the benefit of hindsight, it was a community and a country that was focused on itself at the time. And so some of the debates that you're having now, I mean, you know this better than I do, the debates you're having now about America's role in the world are not new debates.
Yes.
They're old debates. And so I would say that I felt self-contained in that bubble in the 1970s.
Although I think to an extent that nobody imagined possible now. We have a president who has a very distinct view on this. I mean, there are two distinct views. One is that even if you were to pursue your own interests, that America has an important role to play in the world because you can't isolate yourself from the problems of the world. That's the one I share. But then there's this America first notion that we're going to sort of look inward and not play the role that we've
I think you can say that to put America first, you've got to recognize you're part of the world, not separate from it.
Well, and not just part of it, because America's played a role since World War II, as you know, you're a student of this. That's been an essential role as a convener of global institutions.
Yeah, I call it the anchor of the global system.
Yeah,
and your most recent ambassador to London mm-hmm. Corrected me and said, "No, we are the ballast of the global system, not just the anchor of the global system." But they both convey the same point, and I think it's really important to say that America has been the anchor of the global system. It's borne the burdens of globalization, but it's also reaped extraordinary benefits as a result of it. And the political challenge, obviously, is a lot of Americans don't think they've reaped the benefits.
Yes.
And that seems to be the anvil on which a lot of modern politics, both American and European is breaking.
Yes, we're seeing. I don't want to jump ahead in the discussion, but we're seeing a lot of that on both sides of the ocean. Clearly, that's a lot of what drove President Trump's election. Now we've seen a series of European elections. Brexit was a reflection of it, but just in the last few days, the election in Austria was one more example where a populist nationalist right did very well. We saw some of that in Germany. So this is an issue with all advanced economies. And you're right that Americans, there are benefits of globalization, but there's an awful lot of disruption. And I think technology is as big as globalization itself. One of my concerns and I'm eager for your thoughts on this. I worry that our democratic institutions are built to be a little lumbering, a little bit plodding, so that decisions are made with due debate, consideration, reflection, our checks and balances are in place and so on. And yet technology, communications technology, technology as it affects the economy is moving at such a rapid rate that it puts pressure on democratic governments to be agile enough to respond to the challenges that are being created.
It does, but I would argue that it's the route to hell to try and get democratic institutions to work at warp speed.
Yes.
And in fact, the genius of the strongest democratic systems, interestingly enough, one example is one that our countries helped to create in Germany after the Second World War, mm-hmm. is that it's built to generate long-term consensus, not short-term yes. chasing of the latest fad. And I think that I don't want to sound naive, because politicians have to deliver over a 4 or 5 year cycle. Equally, the best politicians are able to link what they're doing over 4 or 5 months and then 4 or 5 years to a longer time frame. Where I'm concerned is that you can make a far too powerful argument today that the autocratic parts of the world are better at thinking long-term than the democratic parts of the world. And I think that is a great challenge, because even 5 years ago, but certainly 15 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to make that argument. We're meeting in the week that the Chinese Communist Party holds its 19th Party Congress, and it will present not just a clear vision of China's future, but a clear vision of how China is going to engage with the wider world, including the 62 countries who are part of the One Belt, One Road initiative. And you will see a combination of economics, politics, culture brought together in a very coherent, tight way. And that is a challenge to the Western democracies, both in its core ideology and essence. You don't have to believe that China wants to dominate America to see that it's presenting an alternative vision of how to organize society. And it's one that I think we have to take very seriously, because you're right to worry, I think, that the Western democratic institutions are showing themselves neither fast enough to keep up with the technology, to go back to your question, nor strategic enough to make the long game seem worth betting on. And that is obviously one of the central challenges for the modern world.
Yeah. Well, I think that the disruption that technology is creating, it creates enormous opportunity. The disruption that it creates, though, I think has been underestimated as a force, as a societal force. And then when you overlay communications and the ability through social media to kind of harvest people's anxieties, resentments, you know, you see the opportunity for the autocratic candidate to say, you know what, we're just going to do this. We're going to take care of this. We're going to take care of you. I think that that simplicity of message was one of the things that made Trump appealing to the voters that he addressed. His thing was, I will take care of it. Make me president. I will take care of it. Now he's running into the reality of governance, which is, as you know, far more complex. But I think that complexity is is what he ran against in certain ways. Nuance is what he ran against. The reality of the world as we find it is what he ran against. And there was a market for that, and there's a market in these other countries for it. But we should go back to your story, because you at a very, very early age entered into politics through policy. You came to the Labour Party in Britain at a time when it had a setback and was reinventing itself.
We had four setbacks. We lost four elections in a row, remember? 79, 83, 87, 92. So in 94, Tony Blair asked me
92,
to...
92, though, I think there was an expectation that you would break that string.
We thought we'd win, and we didn't. Because actually the last 100 yards for getting to power are in some ways the hardest.
Yeah.
Because it's when the voters take you most seriously and you're under the greatest scrutiny. I mean, you know it better than I do.
Yes.
So, no, my job was to run policy for the then opposition. We had to get rid of policies that would neither work and were unpopular, and we had to find policies that were both popular and would work. And that is the origin of the minimum wage. That's the origin of the investment in youth jobs programs. That's the origin of the reforms to the National Health Service. That's the origin of the education commitments that we made. And it became, I would argue, not just a successful period of electoral politics. We won three elections on the trot. But it became, by British standards, a very reforming and positive period. There's a revisionist history which wants to say this was all about Iraq and the financial crisis. And I think that doesn't do justice to the changes that went on, economic, social, political, that went on within the country. But that's obviously contested terrain.
Two things can be true. Those things could have been a hindrance to Labour in retaining power, and yet there was progress during those periods. Let me just take a quick break, and we'll be right back with David Miliband. I had interrupted you when, and you were talking about the progress that was made during the Blair Brown years.
Yeah, I think this has modern relevance, doesn't it? Because there's one school of thought which says, look, politics since the 1980s, since the Reagan-Thatcher period, on both sides of the Atlantic, has been a seamless progression of deregulation, anti-statism, etc., quote-unquote neoliberalism. And there's another school of thought which says, hang on, in the 90s and the 2000s, governments of the centre-left actually made important changes in their societies. And that's relevant not just for historians, because it's important in defining where does progressive politics go today. As you know in your own country, as is evident across Europe, there's no point in trying to repeat the old recipes. Social democrats, progressives are getting beaten when they try to repeat the past. And I think it is relevant to charting a course forward, whether you think it was simply the fact that those governments were prisoners of an alternative ideology, or whether you think they were actually doing what social democrats have done throughout the ages, which is to bring the social dimension into the operation of a market economy.
Yeah, I want to get to that in the context of your leadership battle there, and just looking at where we are today in both Britain and the U.S.
Yeah,
but
without forgetting the refugees, which is what I'm committed to at the moment.
No, we absolutely won't, because I actually think that's clearly part of what's going on right now.
Yeah.
Even a more pronounced way in Europe than here, but on both sides of the pond. But you then ran for Parliament, and you were elected at an early age in 2001, and immediately went into the cabinet.
I didn't. I spent 3.5 years as a junior minister, so not in the cabinet.
I see.
So I did some form of apprenticeship before I was given real power.
Yes. Your first cabinet position was?
Secretary of State for the Environment was
right.
My first.
And where you led on the issue of climate change.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Tony Blair asked me to become Secretary of State for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs, and I remember saying to him, look, I don't know one end of a cow from another. How can you put me in charge of rural affairs? And he said, look, you can figure that out. They'll be able to explain that to you.
But as long as you know the end of the cow where you can capture the methane.
Exactly.
That's important, yes.
What we need to do is really put ourselves at the forefront on the climate issue, where he understood, I think, that a low-carbon economy was not just an environmental imperative, it was an economic imperative. And I think that that was really a testing ground for me, because I think that the politics of the environment is obviously local. It is about local schemes for insulation to save people money, but it's also about global action. And this was a period we commissioned the Stern report, which showed for the first time the economics of battling climate change actually spoke to the economic benefits of doing so rather than just the cost.
Were people receptive to that? Because we, you know, I was in the White House with Obama when we were pushing for cap and trade. And
there was an extraordinary moment in 2006-07 when people really did buy it. Mm-hmm. You had business, you had government, you had people. It was before the financial crisis. I think it was different for you coming afterwards. And there was a real sense that this was not just an environmental imperative, but an economic opportunity. And frankly, that's still the view in some European countries. It's dropped off the agenda in the UK, but in Germany, to some extent in France, it's still pretty core to the economics of the future. And one of the striking things about your election, watching your election last year, is that I think it's right, 3 times as many people are working in solar than are working in coal. Mm-hmm. But it's probably 30 times the amount of political sway that goes for someone who's a coal miner than who's working in solar. But at that time, we managed to get cross-party support. So Labour, Conservative, Liberal, for a bill which bound Britain's carbon emissions to decline by 60%, later refined to 80%, by 2050. We set a 40-year course for the way in which we would drive towards a low-carbon economy. That's still in place today. And it was that combination of government leadership, business innovation, and popular mobilization. Those 3 points, I think, are always core to any successful reform program. And they were present in the stars were aligned at that period.
President Obama was a leading proponent of the Paris Accord, which obviously took place after you left office. President Trump has now withdrawn from it. Where do you think the world stands now relative to climate action?
I'd like your listeners to know that your dog has become incredibly excited and attentive at the discussion of climate change.
My dog is a major activist.
I mean, where does
issue.
The world stand? Well, there's bad news, obviously, because there's the biggest challenge to the Paris consensus that one could imagine in that the United States has withdrawn. Having said that, renewable energy prices are going down. China is committing heart and soul to making an economic as well as environmental virtue of this.
Because they see an economic advantage as well as a necessity for them,
exactly,
as
right.
Environmental. And
yeah, they see an environment. As yeah. Countries get richer, obviously, they tend to the environment in ways that they didn't before. It's a more mixed picture, but I think in India there's an environmental movement that hasn't existed before, and Europe has held its course. And I think that the market forces of low renewable energy prices are a major new feature on the horizon. 10 years ago, we'd argue that we needed to subsidize these technologies because they will become the energies of the future. Low carbon can become an affordable source of energy, and it is becoming so. And so I think that it's a very mixed picture. I think that we shouldn't underestimate the damage that U.S. withdrawal from the Paris Accord can do.
There is a sort of inexorable momentum to...
Well, you'd hope so, but the trouble is there's going to probably be more and more evidence of the damage of climate change, and mm-hmm. we see that every day in our work. Look, the work we're doing in Niger, yes. Across the Sahel, climate is a feature of daily life for people, and they'll say to us, look, the water isn't where it was when my grandparents were tending this land.
Yeah.
And so it's part of the
In fact, you know, in
modern
the
life,
military intelligence reports on climate change have all warned that climate change will be a disruptive element and will create mass migration and the kinds of problems that we're beginning to see. I can't let you go from this part of this conversation without asking about Iraq, because it is part of the story and one that gets talked about a lot. You said that it was kind of maybe a bit of a myth that was a defining event. But Tony Blair was very much aligned with George Bush in Iraq. You voted to go into Iraq. In retrospect, forget about whether it was the right vote or the wrong vote.
No, it was the wrong vote.
What was the impact of that? As you look back now, we're still We still see the unrest in Iraq. We see the sectarian struggles that are going on in that region.
Well, I think it was the wrong vote, and I think I don't buy the arguments that it was done for malign reasons. It wasn't done for oil, but it was nonetheless a major strategic error. It was a major strategic error because the war in Afghanistan was not concluded, and it was a major strategic error because it undoubtedly emboldened and reinforced Iranian strength in the region. I was the education minister at the time. I voted to support the government. But it's undoubtedly the biggest foreign policy mistake of that government. My point is, the government was about more than mm-hmm. that. Now, politically, it's been a stick with which it's been beaten. But more important, there are continuing effects
that's
across the
I'm
region.
Really
and that's what
you
you're
about.
Driving at. Yeah. And I think it's impossible to explain anything that's going on in Iraq at the moment without some reference to the war. But that's not the same as saying that everything that is happening in Iraq today is the result of the war. But I think that, there's no question that the destruction of the Iraqi state, the disbandment of the Iraqi army, the series of decisions that were made, in fact, after the war was won, mm-hmm. dissolved Iraqi society in a really dangerous way. And those after effects continue to be felt. And the fact that there is safety in Sulaymaniyah or Erbil or in Duhok, which is the Kurdish area of Iraq, doesn't absolve or excuse the fact that there are continuing ill effects from that decision today. And Ayad Alawi, former Prime Minister of Iraq, wrote a book entitled Winning the War, Losing the Peace. And that, to me, sums up what's happened there.
You became Foreign Secretary under Gordon Brown. You ran headlong into, as we did when we were in the Obama administration. We took office in 2009 at the peak of the economic crisis. How disruptive was that for you? I mean, looking back, did you guys have a chance coming when you did?
Well, I think that Gordon's leadership on the financial crisis was real. He understood its dimensions and the requirement for international action. For me, what was I working on in 2007-8? I was working on a peace plan for the Balkans because the Kosovo dispute wasn't resolved. I was working on the situation in Sri Lanka because of the slaughter that was going on there. But the two biggest things were obviously getting us out of Iraq and winding down in Afghanistan. Now, I think that we also knew that that 2009 summit, which was only 3 or 4 months after you took office, where the G20 came together for the first time to take bold action, that did involve diplomats all around the world working to the government, prime ministerial leadership of a serious kind. And in a very small way, I would say I contributed to that. But I certainly wouldn't want to overestimate that. But what it did was it convulsed Western politics and in some ways continues to convulse Western
politics. Well, I think what it also did was it caused corporations to rationalize themselves to withstand the pressures of the crisis in ways that actually advanced some of this automation I think that it changed us in ways that are not going to be reversed and accelerated this sense of being on one side of the divide or the other side of the divide. So this leads me to the leadership battle. And I'm not going to get into the Cain and Abel deal about you and your brother running against each other for leadership, but you had different views. And it was a debate that it seems to me is still ongoing here, there, over how a progressive party should move forward. I mean, here we have the sort of Sandersites, Bernie Sanders supporters, Bernieacs, they call them, who very much believe that there's fundamental injustice of the economic system, and government has an opportunity, not an opportunity, but an obligation to address it. There are others who shy away from some of the measures. And certainly in Britain, your party, the Labour Party now, is fully in the thrall of Jeremy Corbyn. He's defined it. And he's probably as left as you've seen there. Tell me how you see this definitional battle for the Labour Party, for Democratic Party here. What are the challenges and what are the potential pitfalls?
I think the way to see this is either through a lens of electability or through a lens of desirability. And there's a temptation in political commentary for it always be to be done through the lens of electability. So many people criticised Jeremy Corbyn before the British general election in June on the grounds that what he was proposing was not going to win majority support. And obviously he didn't win majority support, but he came a better second than people
expected.
Which
in politics is a lot. The perception.
Funnily enough, I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but I just spoke to this morning to the defeated Social Democratic candidate for the Norwegian prime ministership, and he said to me, to your point, there are no silver medals in politics.
Yes.
Which I think is I'm more on that side. There are no silver medals in politics. If you're not in government, then...
Although Corbyn wasn't really taken seriously as a leader. Well, there was this presumption that he could not win.
Correct. But nonetheless...
And so now he is strengthened.
He is. He's definitely strengthened because he did better than those who doubted his electability.
Right.
I doubted that he would get 40% of the vote, to be honest with you. But my difference with him... And I think it is more fundamental in a way, which is about whether or not he's proposing the right things for the country. And I think it's that there is a debate on the progressive side of politics about where we pitch ourselves. And it's sometimes framed in terms of austerity, which speaks to the sort of macroeconomic question. But actually, I think it's about much more than that. Jeremy Corbyn's proposal is that the top things he wants to do are nationalize industries. Now, I have a pragmatic view of that. I don't think the privatized water industry in Britain has been a great emblem of anything, really. But I think that that's not the route that I would be saying is the top thing to help build a fairer and more inclusive Britain, where I would be looking more at welfare policy, labor market policy, education policy. And I think there is a difference. What's undoubtedly true is that Jeremy Corbyn has captured a sense of hope, especially among young people, and one has to give him that. In a way, he's spoken to the demand for the speaking in primary colours that you referred to earlier. He's tried to defy the complexity that you said is the enemy of popular mobilisation. And I think there is a continuing debate on the centre-left about the right way to mould and reform and improve market economies. And that's something where none of us are actually winning elections at the moment, neither on, if you like, the centre-left nor the left of centre. So,
I mean, there's a sense
that's
that
my perspective
the corporations there, corporations here, doing very well, very profitable, have recovered from the crisis. Going back to your father's studies, Marx may have been wrong about his prescription, but he wasn't wrong about one part of his analysis, which is when profit is the motive and labor is the biggest cost, if you can reduce your labor costs, you have more profit.
Well, the bigger point, I think, is that there is a tendency of markets to overshoot. And that is what happens when they're not properly organized, regulated, and governed. And that's clearly been the case in the financial sector before 2007. Mm-hmm. God forbid that we haven't actually reformed our banking system sufficiently now and built in sufficient safeguards. But I think that there is a fundamental question about the way our Western economies are structured, which is whether or not they're doomed to this spiral of insecurity, inequality, instability. And that's what the argument is fundamentally about. Can you discipline this globalized market economy in a way that it serves the majority of people or not? Do you have to row back on that global opportunity that's been created? And I think it is a fundamental division. In a way, it's not a new division. It's what social democrats have argued with the harder left, the further left, for the last 100 years. And I think that we'll see how Macron does, because President Macron, in a way, is the poster child for the more centre-left approach, social democratic approach. He's done it actually by breaking the two parties. But he's trying to reform the French state. He says it's not tenable to be spending 56% of national income through the state. It's not tenable to have the labour markets that they have. But we can build a fairer France in the process. Now, that's the... So I'm
already running into some political friction.
Yeah, but I mean, as you know this better than I do, if you're not running into political friction, then you're not doing politics.
No, understood. So, understood. I mean,
he seems to me to have a very healthy attitude about his popularity rating. He says, look, I'm here to do stuff.
Right, which is always best. I think that sense of authenticity is very helpful, and sense of direction. You left Britain after your brother beat you in this very narrowly in this party struggle, and you came and you took over in New York the International Rescue Committee. Why did you?
He won the leadership election in October 2010, and I found over the next couple of years that I was caught in this position of either being divisive or being silent, because anything I said was turned into a sort of psychodrama because it was
you and your brother
of a different position, exactly. And the alternative is just to then
be able to... It is. No, I said I wouldn't dwell on it, and I won't, but you can understand why people would be...
Completely.
...sort of interested.
Completely.
In
and
that.
I mean, you've glided over it. There's no need to glide over it. So we fought a leadership election. We had different views. We both were very careful not to say things about each other that we'd then come to regret. There was a difference. But it did play out in such a way that I felt I couldn't be an effective politician because I was doomed to keep my views to myself, and that's no position in politics. The IRC job came up. The organization was founded by Albert Einstein in 1933 to rescue Jews from Europe. But there were three things that immediately spoke to me when I went to visit the website and looked at the organization. The first is that the questions that we address, how do you get education to girls in war-torn parts of Afghanistan? How do you provide medical supplies in Syria? How do you tackle sexual violence in Congo? How do you promote employment of refugees in Uganda or in Jordan? Those are some of the hardest questions in global public policy, so I was attracted by that. Secondly, I felt that IRC was a bit of a sleeping giant, an organization you can't do much better than an organization founded by Einstein. It had the potential to be a leader of the humanitarian sector because it works in 30, 35 war-torn countries. It's not trying to do everything. It's not an anti-poverty organization. It's focused on people whose lives are shattered by conflict and disaster. And I felt it was a sleeping giant, and I felt I could help with that. I could bring the lessons of politics to my leadership of a humanitarian organization. And thirdly, to be honest with you, the fact that my parents had been refugees allowed me to feel that in some way I was closing a circle. Obviously, the people who are refugees today fleeing war and persecution are not the same religion as my parents. They're not the same religion as my parents. World politics is different. But in a small way, I'm closing a circle by trying to make a difference for people who are the victims of war and persecution today. And those three things have driven me over the last 4 years on a journey which has been inspiring in various ways. But also, I have to recognize that today there are more refugees than ever before, yeah, and the gap between what they need and what they're given is greater than ever before.
I want to ask you about that in 1 second. We'll be right back with David Miliband. You could not have imagined when you took this job how much of a need that you would be filling or trying to fill, but we are facing a global humanitarian crisis because of geopolitics in many different parts of the world now. Talk a little about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually incredible when you think that every minute last year, 24 more people were displaced from their homes by conflict or violence or persecution. And you're right to say it's happening on all continents. It's a feature of the modern world. 65 million people, that's one in every 113 people on the planet, has been displaced by conflict. 25 million of them are refugees. That means they've crossed a border into a neighboring state. 40 million are internally displaced. Syria is obviously the poster child for this. 5.5 million refugees into neighboring states. 7.5 million people internally displaced. But it's not just Syria, obviously. You've got old wars carrying on in Afghanistan, in Congo, and new wars starting in South Sudan and most recently in Myanmar, in Burma. 500,000 refugees going into Bangladesh. And what's striking is not just the scale of this exodus of people. It's also the fact that they don't go home. Less than 1% of the world's refugees went home last year. So the average length of a refugee's stay outside their own country is 10 years. And actually, once you've been a refugee for 5 years, that average goes up to 21 years. And I remember when I went to the world's largest refugee camp in Kenya, Dadaab, and I met this woman. She must have been 28 or 30. And she had three kids. And I said to her, do you think you'll... It's Somali refugees in the Dadaab refugee camp. I said, do you think you'll ever go home to Somalia? And she looked at me and she said, what do you mean go home? I was born here. And this was a camp built in 1991, 92 as a temporary refugee camp. And I asked the camp management, of the 300,000 people living in that camp, how many were born there? And they said 100,000 had been born there. So this is a multi-generational problem.
Yeah.
And keeping people alive is only the first part of the battle. We can't. That can't be a sufficient definition of the humanitarian enterprise. It's got to be to help people thrive, not just to help them survive. And so that's why we're dedicating ourselves to not just healthcare and water and sanitation, but education, employment, the things that will give people a chance to make something of their lives.
We talked earlier about the political tensions in Europe and the U.S. This issue of refugees, migrants, and so on are rife with political implications. And you've seen a real resistance. Every single one of these kind of right-wing, populist, nationalist campaigns have at its core a resistance to accepting refugees, to accepting immigrants. That was true here, and it's true in all of these races in Europe. How much does that complicate what you're doing?
Well, it does, obviously, because nowhere more so than here. I mean, the U.S. has traditionally been not just a generous international donor to international aid, and the president's proposed to cut it by 30% along with your diplomacy, but it's also welcomed refugees here. The average across the administrations over the last 30 years has been 95,000 a year. The president's cut it to 45,000. And we're one of the agencies that welcomes refugees at the airport, gets their kids into school, gets them into employment. So it affects us a lot. But obviously, there's a bigger global message that's being sent. When America's in retreat, what is Jordan or Lebanon or Kenya or Pakistan meant to do when they have many times the number of refugees? And it is striking to me. I mean, Jordan is your second closest ally in the Middle East. And it's got 650,000 registered refugees. The government says there's another 600,000 unregistered refugees. The population is 7 million, 7.5 million.
Yeah.
And the king will tell you the country's at quote-unquote boiling point.
Yeah. No, it's a huge...
And so it's a huge thing.
Political
and,
crisis for
equally,
him.
Equally, there's... my diagnosis is on this is that... In the US, there has been a failure to make the case over the last 30 years about what refugees are doing, how they contribute to the society, how, according to the Cato Institute, there's less chance of being killed by a refugee than there is of being struck by lightning in the US. And we're paying the price now for that failure to make the argument and convince people about what refugees are contributing to the economy because and society. Because obviously from Albert Einstein to Madeleine Albright to Sergey Brin, refugees are people who know the value of freedom. They know what this country is giving them compared to the persecution that they've suffered elsewhere. And my goodness, they're not willing to waste that. I think the European example is a slightly different one. What's happened there is that in 2013 and 2014, you could see the roiling crisis in the Middle East was going to produce waves of refugees into Europe. The Pope went to Lampedusa in 2014 and said, the world is showing the globalization of indifference, which is an extraordinary phrase.
Mm-hmm.
And European leaders were so consumed with the Euro crisis and with the Ukraine invasion by the Russians that they didn't have the bandwidth or they failed to find the bandwidth to address the refugee crisis. And as you know well...
Other than Chancellor
Merkel...
Well,
hang on. In 2013 and 2014, they failed to address it.
Yeah, okay.
It then hit a million people arrive in 2015 and one European leader is willing to stand up and say, hang on, this is not the European way to say we're not going to address this problem, not least because it's already in our doorstep, never mind on our... doorstep.
And she paid a big political price for it.
Well, did she? I mean, she's been re-elected with a share of the vote that fell in Bavaria, undoubtedly, but which held its own elsewhere. The Social Democrats, actually the junior partners in the coalition, paid a greater price. And having been to Germany recently, what you see is a country coming to terms with, a big influx of people. A million people are having their asylum claims addressed and audited, probably half that number, 45% of that number will be allowed to stay. And across the country, villages, towns and cities are organizing the integration of those people, in some ways trying to learn from American experience of integrating people. And I think that, funnily enough, I went to Germany, to Berlin a year and a half ago, and I met Mrs. Yeah. Merkel at the height of this argument in February 2016. And she had an extraordinary calm about it. And when I asked her why she was so calm, she said, look, I grew up in East Germany.
Yeah.
I heard and learnt about the post-war movements of people. And then I saw with my own eyes the movement of people after the fall of the Berlin Wall. And this is part of the growing up, the change, the maturation of our society. And I think that she is determined to show that this is something that was right for Germany and has actually put Germany in a position where it's not just paying its historic debts, it's showing the world the way to do this.
The you saw how the issue has been used by the president, I would say, here, linked to the threat of terrorism, and then the immigration issue generally here linked to economic pressures that people are feeling. And we see this replicated elsewhere. Merkel is an unusual leader in her willingness to stand up. How concerned are you about the political climate just shutting the door on and just exacerbating what is already a massive humanitarian crisis?
I'm very concerned because the humanitarian crisis is getting worse around the world. Western countries are tightening their belts when it comes to overseas aid, and they are closing doors when it comes to allowing refugees to come in. And so you have to be worried that the problems will get worse, and untended humanitarian crisis leads to further political crisis. That's the point about the King of Jordan saying he's at boiling point, or his country is at boiling point. I think the issue here that struck me in the campaign was the confusion between the refugees, who the president said were a Trojan horse for terrorism, and the undocumented immigrants, who he said were driving down wages and were a threat to living standards. And the fact is that wherever those two issues become intermingled, the undocumented immigrants in the UK would have been called illegal immigration, mm-hmm. and the refugee issue, you end up with real explosive volatility. Now, I also think it's important to say, though, that when people say to me, what's it like to lead a refugee organization at a time of backlash, I always have to say to them, look, it's not just backlash. For every person who's afraid of a refugee coming to live next to them, there's someone who's going to stand up and say, hang on, this is my heritage. This is my country. I'm going around to those people. I'm baking them cookies. I'm going to make them part of my community. And it's polarization that's happening rather than just backlash. And I think that's what's happened elsewhere as well. And the requirement on policymakers is to get ahead of the problem rather than to always be playing catch-up, which is what is happening at the moment.
Let me ask you how much you think this threat the challenge of open borders contributed to Brexit. And where is that leading?
Well, Brexit is leading to danger and potential disaster for the UK, not just economic disaster, because Britain is in the process of realizing that there is no such thing as a soft Brexit. Soft Brexit sounds cuddly, like your dog.
My dog here, yes. My dog, Mac, is here for listeners.
Yes, there is no soft and cuddly Brexit. There is only hard Brexit. Hard Brexit that involves new rules that require new institutions to pay for them and new people to staff them. But you're right that Brexit was in part a reaction against the open movement of people within the European Union. Mm-hmm. Got to be careful because there was no open borders for people from outside the European Union. But that was undoubtedly part of the story. David Cameron, I think, was overconfident about his ability to win the referendum and so didn't prosecute the argument that there needed to be what's called in the European parlance an emergency break that would allow countries with a high number of intra-European migrants to put controls on. But it was undoubtedly part of the story. However, the fact is that the areas that were most virulent in their opposition to immigration into Britain were not those areas that had the most immigrants.
That is true here in the US as well.
So the argument, those people are looking for an economic answer, And we've got to give them a better economic answer than shutting the door on people who are actually not affecting their lives. And that's undoubtedly part of the story here, because there was a, as you say, there was a similar story. My own view is that this refugee issue, in a way, is a canary in the mine for the fate of globalization. Because after the Second World War, if you look at this historically, the world learned its lessons of the interwar period. It learned its lessons that global cooperation was necessary, and that if it wasn't forthcoming, then there would be explosion. Refugees got rights in the same way that the United Nations was built, NATO was built, institutions of the post-war period of global cooperation were built. We're now at a point where I think if the rights of refugees are rolled back, that will be a harbinger for the fate of globalization itself. It will be a telltale sign that the world can't organize to build a more stable, a more secure, a more equal form of globalization. And we're going to see retrenchment. And the ultimate, not just irony, but terrible paradox is that people who will suffer the most are those who think that they're actually helping themselves by bolting the door. And that's the core of the modern political challenge for all parties, really.
Before we run, I need to ask you, do you ever see yourself going back and re-engaging in British politics?
I mean, I feel very lucky to be doing what I'm doing at the moment. And so I feel very committed to that. Whenever people ask me that, I always say, look, I don't know what I'm going to do next. What I do know is I'm going to do something that allows me to put my passion and my experience and whatever skills I have to good use. And I feel I'm making more difference at the moment leading a global NGO which helped 26 million people last year than anything else. And as long as that's the case, that's what I'm going to do.
Being a long time observer of politicians, I put great meaning in the words "at the moment," but we'll leave it there.
Yeah,
I applaud you for what you're doing. You're doing the Lord's work here, and it's such important work. But clearly, you still have a passion for a whole range of issues that are involved with this, but not limited to it, and. I suspect we'll be hearing more from you. But I so appreciate you being here today, being at the Institute of Politics, and look forward to future conversations.
Thank you very much, David.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast and subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.